Last week in San Francisco, a government agency shut down cell phone service as we become more dependent on our technologies. What happens when the plugs get pulled with no advance notice? This hour, we'll talk about technology and free speech. Plus, SpaceX plans to launch its Dragon spacecraft later this year. If all goes well, it'll dock at the International Space Station. SpaceX CEO Elon Musk is here to talk about the history-making trip. And a look at Google's purchase of Motorola Mobility. Is the search giant getting into the mobile phone business? Some answers and your questions after the break. Stay with us.
You can support the show by trying Audible.com with over 75,000 audiobooks, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/Science Friday. Now on to the show.
This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. Earlier this week, Google snatched up Motorola Mobility to the tune of $12.5 billion. Google already makes an open-source mobile phone operating system, Android, so this would appear to give Google the opportunity to manufacture its own branded phones running on its own software, right? Well, maybe not, because Google's been downplaying the manufacturing aspect of the deal, pointing instead to Motorola's tens of thousands of patents as motivation for the acquisition. But you can't help but wonder, is Google getting into the mobile phone business? Is it ready, willing, and able to challenge Apple and the iPhone iPad juggernaut? How worried should Apple be, if at all? Might we see not just Google smartphones, but tablets also? If competition is good, then maybe we all win in this deal. What do you think? Do you like the Google gobble of Motorola? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Glenn Fleischman is a contributor to the Economist.com Babbage blog. He's also a writer for the online news site Tidbits and the Seattle Times. He joins us from KUOW in Seattle. Welcome to Science Friday, Glenn.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what's your take on the deal? Why did Google do this?
Well, I think the focus has been on patents, and Google missed out on the Nortel patents a few weeks ago, where Apple, RIM, and Microsoft formed a consortium and sort of snatched that away from them. And I think Motorola is the other low-hanging fruit from the patent side. They need a defensive portfolio of patents because otherwise they're not doomed, but they're in a position where they have to have some strength to defend themselves. This is all kind of, you know, people sitting around at a table and you look at the stacks of paper and say, whose stack is bigger? Motorola has 20 already assigned, and that's a big portfolio to help leverage what Microsoft, Apple, RIM, and all the other companies, yeah. Nokia, Qualcomm, everyone else in the space has.
What strength do all these patents give you in practical terms?
It's defensive, really. I mean, these companies, you know, you can see cases in which one firm wants to prevent another from going to market with something, like Apple trying to keep Samsung tablets off the market in Europe. But really, the companies don't benefit from trying to keep products off the market. They need to compete in the market. There's a competitive advantage there, but then they can be the victim of the same approach. So this is kind of a nuclear war. You don't really want to do a first strike because if you do, you know that there's all this other retaliation, including from other member states, not the first worlds.
But it's hard to deny that Google has an Android operating system and now it has access to all these patents. Why not go the Apple route, make the hardware and the software for it?
Well, and that's exactly what they've got to do now. I mean, they didn't buy, you know, I made this joke the other day that Google woke up and said, oh, we just acquired 20,000 employees along with the 25,000 patents. And Google hasn't been a hardware company. They've had other companies. You know, Apple controls everything from start to finish. Even though they have a contractor make their products, they work very, very closely with them. And only one company or companies make Apple products. There's no licenses. Mm-hmm. So Google has the opportunity to make something that is a completely realized version of their vision of what a mobile phone or mobile tablet should be and control every stage of the process. No one else can gainsay what they want to do.
Does that mean that they're going to clamp down on this open source Android platform?
It's very tricky. Once you let the open source cat out of the bag, you can't put it back in. The NAPE being free and unlicensed, but it's not. There's very stringently defended licenses beneath most open source code, as distinct from free software that is license free. So Android, once it's been released, there are discussion that Amazon might come out with its own tablet. Amazon could take everything that is Android up until some moment and say, well, we're going to take this and modify it and not call it Android. We'll use all the same code and call it the Amazoid tablet operating system. And they'd be perfectly within their rights to do so. So there is still the potential for competition from companies taking the Android source code and making
tablet makers, boiling down to the big three.
That's what it feels like right now. We've got Apple, we have Microsoft, we have Google, and HP just took itself out of the running yesterday, which is, it's baffling because they haven't lost that much money in relative terms to what they could gain if they actually got a foothold in the tablet or smartphone world. But yeah, three big companies and they're enormous and no one could really reach the scale to compete against them now because they're so entrenched in the marketplace.
Google, as we say, has had Android, but is Android is it in some way in danger of losing its market?
Well, it could, because Google, till now, has been licensing it, Android itself is free as an operating system. If you're a Microsoft customer, if you're Nokia, for instance, you pay some fee to use the phone. Android, you don't pay a fee as a cell phone maker to use it. But Google's controlled the Android name. You can't call it an Android without their approval, controlled access to the application marketplace, the Android market, controlled access to Google apps and services like driving directions. So there has been that level of control. But they've got HTC, LG, Samsung, and Motorola, other companies have all, and dozens and hundreds of smaller ones, have all licensed Android and put it into the marketplace. And the question is, do they want to compete against a Google-owned hardware company?
Right.
I don't think anyone has a clear answer yet. They don't know. If you look at there's a page of quotes at Google's site from all of their partners, their Android partners, and it reads like the Stepford Wives. So these quotes, we're very happy. If you read this, this is the ultimate public relations issue where Google said, hey, would you say something like we're really happy about the defensive action that this acquisition represents? And HTC says, we are very happy about the patent acquisition defensive position, page and page of quotes like that.
You know what the irony here is, as someone who's watched this business for 40 years, is that Apple used to get killed by people, these competitors, saying, why are you in the hardware business? Right? And they even went out of they even actually licensed their hardware for a little bit. Didn't work out very well, but kept, saying, when you buy a Mac or an Apple, you're buying the hardware as well as the software, and people laughed at them. And now they're all coming back to that side.
Yeah, well, it used to be you couldn't make something good enough and cheap enough to compete in the marketplace. And Apple has figured out how to sell enough products at high enough margin that they have this $75 billion plus cash war chest, and they can buy every tablet screen of the quality they want for the next 5 years from the companies that make it and all their competitors that are paying a higher cost for lower quality components. So Apple used to be, it was the high cost product, and now an iPad is actually relatively cheap for the features it delivers compared to any of the competitors on the market. That's a tricky competitive position to be in.
So what do you think Apple's take in their boardroom is now on this decision? Are they just are they saying, we welcome your challenge and just, try to take us on, or what?
I think they're laughing and laughing and rolling around in piles of dollar bills, because this is the affirmation of so many years of Apple strategy. This is the ultimate confirmation. They're the biggest or second biggest company in the world by stock market capitalization. Their competitors have fallen by the wayside. Microsoft won't have a tablet till next year. This is going to affect the Android market, even if Motorola produces a fantastic tablet under Google's guidance. So Apple says, I guess everything we did turned out right, didn't it?
Let me get a quick phone call in. John in Concord, North Carolina. Hi, John.
Hope this comes through okay on a headphone, but I have dealt firsthand with Google Docs and Google Mail, and was totally disappointed in their support. I just hope their support, if they do start building hardware, is going to be better than it is for Google Docs and Gmail.
Good point. Thanks, John. What do you think, Glenn?
Yeah, it's a real issue. I mean, Apple has this huge advantage of, again, the thing that everyone laughed at them for, all these retail stores, but now they have hundreds of places around the U.S. and hundreds more around the world where you can go in. You have a problem with the phone. You go in there and they go, my wife's had to go in with her phone. Everyone, you know, has a story about if they have a problem. You go in there and say, something's wrong with this. And under warranty, they say, ah, you're right. Here's another phone. See you later. Just plug it into your computer and it's back up and running. And it's having a single infrastructure, having that hands-on touch. I've had to send my laptops back to Apple and there's no questions asked. And 2 days later, I get either a new one or it's completely replaced when it's under warranty. And that will go a long way. That goes a long way. Google doesn't like people very much. It's always been my impression. They want to keep people arm's length away and let the algorithms, the automatic things, the user support forums handle everything.
Well, you know, we're entering the school buying season and the holiday buying season when we typically see all the new hot stuff coming out. Could Apple throw down the gauntlet this fall and say, yeah, okay, Google, try to match this with some who knows what kind of iPad or iPhone coming out?
Yeah, well, there were rumors that they might come out with yet another model of iPad, maybe a higher resolution screen in the September-October timeframe. There's clear evidence. In fact, some of the cell carriers have said openly there's another iPhone, the iPhone Model 5, will be coming out in that timeframe. And Android will have this new version of their operating system, 4.0 Ice Cream Sandwich, the code name, will be out around then as well.
Ice Cream Sandwich.
They like food at Google. Current release.
I've been there. I've seen their. They got great cafeteria over there.
They put up giant icons of all these things too. There'll be a giant ice cream sandwich
for Android phones. You think now that's going to change?
For Google is they could release a set of 5 or 10 or 20 phones, but they're all going to work in exactly the same way for developers. And right now, that's not true. Even from a single handset or tablet maker, you don't know that the same Android device as a programmer will function the same way. And if you look at like Netflix has only been able to release its software for a handful of Android phones.
All right. Well, we know we're making we make an Android app on Science Friday, and we know the difficulties on all the different phones.
Right.
Getting them to play the same on all the different phones is not easy. All right. Thank you, Glenn. Thanks for the insight.
This episode of Science Friday is sponsored by Audible.com, which is a leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For listeners of Science Friday, Audible is offering a free audiobook of your choice when you try Audible free for 14 days. One audiobook Science Friday listeners might enjoy is Robopocalypse by Daniel H. Wilson. You may remember Dan from a discussion with Ira on a recent episode of the show to discuss his book about robots taking over the world. And you can get Robopocalypse for free on Audible. Another audiobook is The Quantum Story, A History in 40 Moments by Jim Baggett. Jim suggests that to have a better understanding of what is happening in science today with the Large Hadron Collider and CERN, you need to know something about the history which precedes them. That's The Quantum Story, A History in 40 Moments by Jim Baggett, available on Audible. And if you'd like to see books Ira is listening to now, go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/SciFry and check out Ira's Best Listens book list. To try Audible today with a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/Science Friday. That's audible.com/Science Friday. Now back to the show.
You're listening to Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. And I'm guessing that if you're like me, along with your house keys, there's something you take everywhere you go. Right, your cell phone or maybe your tablet. And because for most of us, cell phones have become an indispensable part of everyday life, and you expect the service to be available pretty much on 24/7, just about wherever you go, just like you expect the heat and the hot water and the gas and the electricity to be working all the time. But in San Francisco last week, a government agency, Bay Area Rapid Transit, or BART, pulled the plug on cell phone service for a portion of its line in an effort to disrupt protesters organizing a demonstration. They didn't warn anyone that day to beware of the loss of phone service. They didn't make any advance announcements that you're going to lose your cell phone. Is that even legal, or is it a violation of First Amendment rights? The government can't just unexpectedly disconnect your landline phone, right? Why should it be any different for cell phones? And when governments in Cairo or Tehran or Damascus shut down the cell phones or internet, so that protesters can't tweet or video from the site. It's viewed as a blow to free speech. Why is this case different? What do you think? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And if you're on Twitter, you can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI, or go to our Facebook page. Tweet us there or leave a message there, and go to our website at sciencefriday.com and leave a comment. We'd love to hear from you. Let me introduce my guests. Eugene Valick is a professor at the UCLA School of Law who specializes in cyberspace law and First Amendment law. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Valick.
Thanks very much. I should say, I'm not a doctor. Many law professors, we just have JDs. I'm professor, and it's Valick, rhymes with Pollock.
Valick rhymes with like another Pollock who's in Los Angeles. Well, okay, I'll try to get it right. Thank you very much. Kent Paulson is president of the First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. He joins us from a studio there in campus. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Paulson.
Also not a doctor, and good to be with you.
Oh. Well, you're both honorary doctors today, so.
There you go.
Doctor just means learned, and we like to think we're learned.
Well, your moms might be happy to get promoted today. Eugene, what's your take on the BART cell phone shutdown? Did it violate any First Amendment rights, do you think?
I don't think it did, because we're talking here about BART blocking access for cell phones on its own property. And blocking access that, as I understand it, uses cell phone hardware on its property. Here's, at least based on press accounts, as I understand it, BART, which is in the business of trying to provide convenient and reliable service to people, at one point, to maximize convenience, put up cell phone hardware on its property in order that its customers can talk on the phone. Because of the plans for protest, that as I understand wouldn't just be protest, it would be disruption of service, BART decided that it was no longer, for that day, conducive to convenience to provide this cell phone hardware. So BART decided to turn it off for the duration of that day. I think that's something the government is entitled to do. Now, if the government were doing it with regard to private property, for example, as you point out, shutting off your landline, that would pose very serious First Amendment problems. Likewise, if it did it in a traditional public forum, like a park, that might very well pose serious problems as well. When we're talking about the government controlling speech and communication on its non-public forum property, such as transportation networks, generally speaking, the government has a lot of authority, so long as the restrictions are reasonable and viewpoint neutral, and they seem to be so here. So I think in this instance, this particular restriction would probably be constitutional, but broader restrictions that operate on private property, I think that would be unconstitutional, or at least unconstitutional absent a very pressing public emergency.
Ken Paulson, your take.
You know, we can tie ourselves in legal knots talking about whether it's a public forum or a non-public forum. But even if it's a non-public forum, there is a requirement that government's actions be reasonable. And it seems to me that if I'm BART and I'm looking at the possibility of what I think may be a disturbance, a disruption, perhaps an impedance of traffic along the platform, I'm calling in our security. I'm planning police presence. I'm talking about crowd control. I'm not sure I would say, hey, let's cut off cell phones for 3 hours for thousands of people on the off chance that they're not calling for pizzas or calling home. It just seems to me to be an unreasonable and somewhat irrational reaction to this. We're at a disadvantage because BART keeps talking about the intelligence it has. They haven't shared that with us. And there was arguably a constitutional right to a peaceful protest somewhere on the premises. And this strikes me as a gross overreaction and arguably a violation of the First Amendment.
Eugene, any response?
The court has made clear that for First Amendment purposes, transportation networks such as this are not public fora. And in fact, you can't have a protest in the middle of a BART station. You could have one outside it, but not inside it, because it's a non-public forum. Court has also said that the question isn't what we think is the most reasonable, you or I or the justices. It's whether it is a reasonable reaction, and reasonableness tests are usually pretty differential to the government, especially since here the burden is really quite modest. It's supposed to be a 3-hour shutoff, but for any particular rider, It was just for the duration of their trip on the BART. And as I understand it, before the cell phone hardware was put up some years ago, you couldn't use your cell phones at all on BART, and somehow people managed to make do. So I think this is the kind of situation where when you're talking about the government restricting things on its own non-public forum property, it can focus more on its functional goals, which are simply making sure that people get places reliably without slowdowns, without shutdowns of service, even if that means restricting people's speech in a viewpoint-neutral way. My guess is that many BART riders, I think probably most BART riders, have told, look, you can either have a delay of an unspecified likelihood and duration in your trip, or just this one day, you can't use your cell phone on the trip. My guess is that most BART riders would say, I go on BART not to protest and not to talk. I go on BART to get from place to place. And the government has a good deal of authority to make sure that, indeed, the trains run on time.
Well, why not warn them then in advance that this is going to happen?
So that's a plausible argument. It may be good as a matter of customer relations, although maybe it's not so good because either it was a last-minute decision or that warning might have helped people, help the bad people organize their activity. But while that's a good argument about good public service, in some situations a good breach of contract argument, although I don't think that would be in play here, it's not a First Amendment argument. If the government is entitled to restrict, to essentially turn off its cell phone hardware and thus restrict cell phone communication, maybe a bad idea for it to do it without warning, but I don't think there's a First Amendment duty to warn in that kind of situation.
Kent Paulson, does the First Amendment need an update to deal with technology?
No, I actually think it's been incredibly sturdy. When you think about the 45 words ratified in 1791, they've gone unchanged, but of course not unchallenged. They have worked for us with almost every – well, literally with every new generation of technology. James Madison was not thinking about television back in 1791. And yet we've been able to use these core principles, which basically say government cannot interfere with our freedom to express ourselves or to worship the God of our choice. It's worked incredibly well. The courts have been able to adapt those 45 words to generation after generation of technology. And, you know, we shouldn't mess with the core of the First Amendment under any circumstances.
Mm-hmm. How do we keep the moral high ground now in places like, you know, in Syria and other places where the government shuts off the cell phone system? And we say that's a bad thing for freedom of expression and protests, and they're allowed to protest. How do we keep the moral high ground now if we're shutting it off in San Francisco?
Well, the fact is that you can't just try to come up with rules that will apply equally even in times of foreign revolution. And we applaud people who revolt against their government, but if somebody revolts against the government in the U.S., we're of course going to try to shut that down using military force. Likewise, we may applaud people gathering in a public square outside the government, a government building, but if you try to gather without a suitable permit at various places in Washington, D.C., that rightly say, look, you're tying up traffic. This isn't something that that we can allow. My sense is that foreign countries, the Chinese, the Syrians and such, are not going to be terribly moved by the content of our First Amendment doctrine in any case. Conversely, we can't organize our First Amendment doctrine in a way that that would have been optimal for people in a foreign country that doesn't respect constitutional law, constitutional principles, which is why they're trying to revolt against it. So I don't really see the attitude of the Chinese or the likely actions of the Chinese as terribly relevant to the question of what should the authority be of a government body that's trying to implement rules to keep its functioning and keep clients getting to where they paid to get at the right time. I'll give you an example. At our own UCLA Law School, we provide wireless internet access for students because we think it's usually useful. But we turn it off in classrooms, at least in many classrooms, because we're afraid that during class time, being able to access the internet is a distraction. Is that a restriction on speech? Well, yes, in the sense that they can no longer email their friends from the class, or at least it makes it much harder. But I think it's a permissible one because it's just us imposing restrictions on what we're on the property that we own and that we as the government own and that we're trying to use for functional purposes.
Ken Paulson, the Electronic Frontier Foundation has compared the cell phone shutoff to the internet shutoff in Egypt. Is that you agree with Eugene that this is not a good comparison?
Well, that's mildly overheated rhetoric, and I do think other governments and other nations look to us and look for hypocrisy if they can identify it. When you go back to the Wi-Fi example in the classroom, I think it's a little too benign an example. If you used Wi-Fi withdrawal as a punishment, or you targeted certain students and not others with Wi-Fi withdrawal, the case in the BART case, you need to step back for just a minute and say, okay, what are the circumstances surrounding this one? A police officer shot a homeless, mentally ill man to death on a train platform. This caused community outrage and anger because two men had been shot in 2.5 years on train platforms. And so when BART learns that citizens might be coming to its premises, to public and complain about its conduct, it shut off phone service for thousands of people. This wasn't a protest against the war in Afghanistan. This was not a rally about Obama's economic policy. This was about BART turning off cell phones, silencing cell phones to silence its critics. It was a direct correlation. That's why I don't view this as sort of not discriminating against viewpoint. They did it in a 3-hour period because that's when this group of people intended to express themselves.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we get a phone caller to win. Coleman in North Carolina. Hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. First time caller. I just wanted to say Gandhi, Martin Luther King, even Jesus, if you believe, didn't have electricity, and they managed to create great commotions and do great good with just people getting out, painting on signs. They didn't have electricity. So let's take electricity out of the equation and see if these people could raise all the cane they're raising.
Ken, do you have any comment?
Well, imagine how effective Gandhi would have been with a Twitter account. I do think there are powerful speakers throughout history whose messages have been heard. But the extraordinary communications we have now amplify. I mean, this is the golden age of the First Amendment. Free the internet, Wi-Fi access, universal Wi-Fi access is really kind of the killer app of the First Amendment, and it's an extraordinary time. And the irony, of course, is that each of us has more powerful freedom of speech and freedom of press because of the reach of what we do, and yet now we kind of labor under the anxiety of, well, what happens if somebody does flick that switch and that extraordinary gift of communications disappears on us.
We're talking about science and technology and communications and the freedom of speech this hour on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow with Ken Paulson and Eugene Volokh. Our number, 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Eugene, how do you react to that? Was the government in this case targeting a specific message? Is it the message, that of the protesters? Is that the right thing for it to do?
So recall that this involved a shutdown of service on the trains. If somebody wants to organize a protest outside a BART station where they have every legal right to do that, they would be perfectly free to do that by communicating to people who are not on trains or who get the message before they get on train or get the message after they get on train. This is really a very modest restriction, and therefore I think one that's not terribly useful to shut down ordinary legitimate protests against BART. Lots of protests can still happen, and BART wasn't trying to stop them and wouldn't be able to stop them this way. As I understand it, BART's concern was that people, rather than lawfully protesting, were going to illegally, inside BART, not just illegally speak because you're not allowed to have protests inside BART, but rather actually block the doors to keep the passengers from leaving and arriving at the right time. And that, in fact, the worry was because it was illegal, they were going to try to coordinate their actions on the train network by communicating with each other by cell phone. So the worry was about a particular kind of illegal behavior, not lawful protest. And in fact, the shutdown seems to have been to be as well targeted as possible, given the limited tools at the government's disposal, to frustrating that protest while still allowing all sorts of other protests that could happen. So that's why I think this kind of restriction that's targeted to the government's use of its own property on its own trains is permissible, even though I agree if the government tried to shut down block-wide cellular by ordering private companies to shut it down, it would be a very different First Amendment question.
Mm-hmm. Last follow-up, Ken?
Well, one of my concerns is that the Associated Press reported this week, Paul Elias reported this week, that BART police had asked employees for any ideas, and this is the quote, good or bad, constitutional or unconstitutional. You know, maybe there was some flippancy in that, but it's unsettling. And although this is, in terms of whether this is a violation of the First Amendment or not, and that can be debated for some time, the bottom line is that this is kind of a wake-up call, and it awakens collective concerns about the power of any agency to cut off our communications for whatever period of time without any kind of check and balance, without any kind of process. And that is unsettling, and it should be of concern to all Americans.
The Chinese did react in talking about Great Britain, but they didn't specify Great Britain's shutting down communications. They said, we may wonder why Western leaders, on the one hand, tend to indiscriminately accuse other nations of monitoring, but on the other, take for granted their steps to monitor and control the internet. So already, you know, the Chinese are talking about the moral high ground, and you can tell us what we do, right or wrong, and then you know you must consider how other people will look at your actions.
And, I don't think we should be running our transportation systems with an eye towards how the Chinese can use what we're doing for propaganda purposes. The Chinese will do what they're going to do, and I don't think that our decision to shut down cell phone service on board is going to affect.
Well, they're already stuck with our treasury bill, so we don't have to worry about that. They're already paying for that. Gentlemen, we've run out of time. I want to thank you very much for taking time to be with us. Eugene Volokh is professor at the UCLA School of Law, who specializes in cyberspace law and First Amendment. Kent Paulson is president of the First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. Gentlemen, thank you for taking time to be with us today. And have a good weekend.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, Elon Musk is going to join us. He's made a few appearances here, and he's going to talk about SpaceX Corporation, and they're going to be visiting. His newest spaceship is going to be visiting the International Space Station, first time for a private venture. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We are about to get one step closer to commercial space travel. This November, the SpaceX Corporation is planning to launch its new Dragon spacecraft from Cape Canaveral. If all goes well, the craft will rendezvous with the International Space Station about 9 days later and seal its place in history as the first privately built spacecraft to dock with the space station. Now that the shuttle program is over, NASA hopes that private companies like SpaceX will fill the void and be a cheaper, better way to deliver supplies to the space station. Whether they'll also deliver astronauts, well, who knows? That remains to be seen. And you can take some of that credit, too, if you ever bought anything online and paid with PayPal, because the founder of the SpaceX company owned PayPal, sold it, and took the money to start up this private space venture, among other companies. We'll talk about some of those, too, with Elon Musk. He is the founder, CEO, and chief technology officer for the Space Exploration Technologies Corporation, SpaceX, also CEO and product architect of Tesla Motors. Maybe we'll ask him how Tesla's doing. He's with us on the phone. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
Tell us about the Dragon spacecraft. How big is it?
Well, it's about 13 feet in diameter and a little maybe 15 feet tall. And it has it does have sort of a capsule gumdrop shape. It's capable of carrying 7 astronauts, same as the shuttle, and up to 6 tons of cargo to the space station.
Wow! And you, it is working so well that your flight schedule got upgraded.
We've been able to advance the schedule and combine the next 2 test flights into one. So the current plan of action is to dock with the space station in December.
And so the launch, you don't have a specific launch date. You just have a launch window in December.
Well, we have a nominal launch date, which is actually November 30th, and then we'll do a series of maneuvers in orbit. I mean, Dragon is a robotic spacecraft, so there's no one on board, and it's doing all this automatically. So we're going to go up there, conduct a series of maneuvers, essentially virtually dock with a virtual space station. If that looks good, then we'll go and dock with the real thing.
Mm-hmm. And how much money does this save NASA over launching its own?
Well, we're about a tenth the cost of the space shuttle per flight. Although the space shuttle is a bigger vehicle, but we carry the same number of people as the space shuttle, and there's no longer a need to carry space station modules up there as there was in the past. So this is an order of magnitude improvement in NASA's ability to get to the space station with cargo and then in a few years with astronauts. So we're really happy to be doing this in partnership with NASA.
Do you think NASA will allow you to carry astronauts?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
We're working closely with the commercial crew team at NASA, and we have a whole game plan of milestones that we have to achieve over the next few years, and we're steadily addressing all of them.
Mm-hmm. What about going beyond the space station? Any plans to the moon or to Mars?
Well, long-term, the goal of SpaceX is to create the technology that's necessary to make life multiplanetary. So Mars is really the only viable candidate for making life multiplanetary, and so that's our focus in the long term. And I'm maybe a little too optimistic sometimes or overconfident, but I think we've got a shot of making that happen in 10 to 20 years.
Going a round trip.
Correct. Yeah, round trip.
Because we do have scientists who come on and say it's not feasible to go in both directions.
Well, it's certainly difficult, but it's difficult but feasible.
Mm-hmm. And would you try to go to the moon before you went to Mars?
Well, I don't personally have a huge interest in the moon, but if there was a customer, NASA or a private customer, that wanted to go to the moon, we would be happy to take them there.
Mm-hmm. Any chance that you could turn taking astronauts to the space station as a tourist business?
Well, that has been the case to date with the Soyuz. The Soyuz has taken up several private astronauts, if you will, that have paid anywhere from $20 to $35 million per flight per seat. It would be great to bring that business to the United States instead of having the Russians have that business, because usually it's Americans that are paying the Russians to do it. It's better if the Americans pay an American company to do it.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the rocket ship that you've built. The Dragon spacecraft is going to fly on the Falcon 9. Tell us about that rocket.
Sure. So Falcon 9 is a pretty big rocket. It's about 1 million pounds of thrust, which is four times the thrust of a 747. It weighs about as much as a fully loaded 747 on takeoff. The 9 refers to the 9 engines on the base. It's designed for super reliability, so that you can lose any of the engines, including right after liftoff, and still complete your mission. So we're the only rocket that can do that. And then later in flight, you can actually lose more than one engine and still complete the mission. So I think that's a pretty significant reliability improvement. It's designed to have higher structural safety margins than other rockets. So we design our rocket to 40% above flight loads instead of 25%.
It will have an escape system, which the shuttle really did not have a practical one.
Yes, the escape system is actually on the Dragon spacecraft. So Falcon 9 is the booster that delivers the spacecraft to orbit, and then the Dragon spacecraft maneuvers over to the space station, docks, and comes back either with people or with cargo. But we are doing something that is very new, and sort of really pushing the state of the art with Dragon, which is we're building the launch escape engines into the sidewall of the Dragon spacecraft. So rather than having this big solid rocket motor tractor on the nose of the spacecraft, which is how it's been done in the past, we're actually integrating the engines into the spacecraft. If you go to our website, spacex.com, you can see what I'm talking about. It's a little hard to describe.
Well, so the capsule, as we used to call them, the capsule will fly, be able to fly on its own to escape, is basically what you're saying, with its own rocket engine on it.
Yes, and the Dragon has Dragon spacecraft has onboard propellant for orbital maneuvering and deorbit and for controlling its reentry. But you either need to escape to do launch escape, or you need to do orbital maneuvering, but not both. And so we're getting dual use of the propellant, and it ends up being a much lighter, I think, much more reliable system by doing that. Mm-hmm. It solves two reliability issues that have existed in the past. One is that tractor tower, escape tower, has to always be jettisoned on every mission, or the crew will die. It's sort of like having a fighter jet with an ejection seat that's got to work on every flight, or you die. And that, I think that's unwise. And then because that tractor tower is so heavy, it has to be discarded a few minutes into the launch, and so you don't actually have escape capability all the way to orbit. But in our case, with the integrated engines, we avoid those issues. And then there's an added advantage, which is we can use those same engines to do a propulsive landing. So you can actually land Dragon with the accuracy of a helicopter, and anywhere on Earth.
Wow, you mean so it's a reusable spacecraft?
Yeah, that's the intent. Yeah, in fact, the Dragon that the Dragon that came back in our December flight, we could refly that same Dragon with minimal refurbishment.
And so, if it's reusable and it comes back, how many launches could you do in a year theoretically?
Well, with Dragon, we could probably do. Well, I think we'd want to do some upgrades. But in the current configuration, we could probably do a launch a week, I guess, with Dragon. But we do need to make the rockets reusable as well. The first and second stage of the rockets.
Hmm. So they will be recoverable.
The intent is to. I mean, the holy grail in space is to have a fully and fully and rapidly reusable rocket. No one has ever achieved this. The space shuttle is partly reusable, but the main tank is thrown away every time, and even the parts that are reusable are extremely difficult to refurbish. And so the space shuttle costs anywhere from 4 to 8 times as much as an expendable rocket of equivalent payload capability. So it's... And all the other rockets are just fully expendable.
Yeah.
So whether it's SpaceX or some other company, whoever invents the first fully and rapidly reusable rocket will be a huge, huge breakthrough, because it would allow the costs of launch to drop by about 100.
Mm. And you aim to be the people who do that, the company that does that.
That's our aspiration.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of your other aspirations in the few minutes I have left, because you're into so many things. Like, tell us about Solar City. You're making solar-powered electric vehicle charging available across this. Tell us what that project is. It sounds fascinating.
Solar City is currently the largest provider of solar-powered systems in the country, mm-hmm. Providing for rooftop installations. So. They have customers like Walmart and Intel, eBay, and then they do a huge number of residential solar systems. They have the best cost structure and the best service, I think, I got of any solar company. Just did a big deal with Google to provide solar financing for customers. Mm-hmm. They're just doing incredibly well. I don't run the company on a day-to-day basis. That's done by Lyndon and Peter Rive, the co-founders. So I just show up at board meetings to hear the good news.
Yeah, you are the chairman, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about something more that you do know about, your car company. When do we expect to see a Tesla that's come down, your second-generation car?
That's all looking really good. We're planning to deliver the Model S to customers in the middle of next year, and then on October 1st we're going to have a big customer ride event and factory tour. So it's exclusively for customers that have put down a deposit on our Model S sedan. And I think they'll be really blown away by the capabilities of the car. I think it's going to be people really going to be really going to love it when they see what it's like. You know, the Model S sedan has a range of up to 300 miles, pure electric. There's a performance version that could beat a BMW M5 around a track. So it's got great performance, handling. I think the styling is great. We're also aiming for it to be the safest car in the world in terms of being 5-star in every single category, no car is 5-star in every category.
And what's the price you're asking for this car?
It starts at $50,000. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a price similar to a BMW 5 Series.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now we're talking with Elon Musk this hour on Science Friday from NPR. And talking about that Tesla, because I did see your profile in the Revenge of the electric car. So it was kind of interesting to watch you dealing with your customers there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And can you bring it in on time and on schedule, as they always ask?
At this point, there's really not a lot of uncertainty associated with the Model S. We've sourced all of the components in the car. The factory's making great progress. I think the car is actually better than what people expect it to be.
And so what? So why have you succeeded when everybody says can't do, you can do? What is your secret to making this work?
We've got a tremendous team at both Tesla and SpaceX. We've really tried to recruit the best engineers in the world. And provide an environment that is conducive to rapid innovation, and kind of just really applying the kind of the Silicon Valley operating system to companies.
Does it have a lot to do with just attitude that we can do this and we'll just do it?
Well, I think certainly a positive attitude is a good idea. But you have to have outstanding engineering that's coupled with that, and I think generally the company that can attract the best engineers and motivate them and have a work together well will result in the best product. That's how it is when technology is concerned.
Let me ask you one final question. As we know, that getting back to space travel, it can be dangerous. Would an accident that resulted in the loss of life just about put you out of business if that ever happened?
No, I don't think so. One always has to take that into account. In the early days of SpaceX, we did have some launch failures as we were developing the Falcon 1 rocket, which is a sort of a small kind of subscale rocket. But we recovered from those, figured out what went wrong, and then applied those lessons with the Falcon 9, the much larger rocket. So we could certainly withstand several failures.
All right. I want to thank you very much for taking down the view. Do you have any other plans we don't know about? Anything else on the drawing board that we should be looking forward to? Are you not afraid of your competitors?
No. I believe it in just staying really focused on creating the best possible product and creating products that amaze and delight customers. And if you do that, then I think you create a valuable company. And I think people sometimes forget that great companies are built on great products. Mm. And so our focus is just making the best products in the world.
All right, Elon, thank you for taking time to be with us today, and good luck to you.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome. Elon Musk, founder and CEO and chief technology officer for SpaceX. He's also CEO and product architect of Tesla Motors. He's joining us on the phone. Some of you have asked us, why is it necessary to include ads in these podcasts? It's a good question. The simple answer is we have to find some way to pay for them. NPR does not underwrite our podcasts or any of our social media, like our website or our videos. In fact, they only contribute 10% of our total budget. So instead of charging you for this podcast, we put in a couple of ads. If you'd like to help close that deficit, please go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the support button and donate a few bucks. Thanks.